This is the Breaking Bad Advice Podcast, the show that is dedicated to helping you stay rational in these irrational times. Here's where I remind you that the following thoughts and conversations are for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Please reach out to your financial professional at Plan Financial to discuss your unique situation and circumstances. All right, well, welcome everybody back to 2024, first episode of Breaking Bad Advice. Isaac, welcome back to the show. I've missed you.
Yeah, it's a new year. Same old though, huh?
Exciting times ahead of us, just like always.
That's now, right.
You know, we are coming into some very, very interesting times over the past year. There have been a lot of moments of, this is it. This is finally it. Although, the end of 2023, we did see kind of a little appetizer, if you will, of what we think is likely to come over the next 12 to 18 months. We won't get into that specific area today. Today's episode is going to be all about the S&P 500 and how it is sustainably unsustainable. So let's go ahead and just jump right into it. We're going to take a look at the concentration, if you will, within the S&P 500. Now, we have the Dow Jones, we have the NASDAQ, but the S&P 500 really kind of encaptures, you know, the huge, large cap companies within the U.S. stock market, if you will. So, Isaac, why don't you dive into that concentration, talk a little bit about the Mag 7 and what that means within the S&P 500.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's good to be back, and I like this title, Sustainably Unsustainable. We're all into, everybody's into sustainable energy and sustainable, I don't know, everything else. and you know, why not make it sustainable stock investing, except not so sustainable these days. And that's kind of what we're going to get into. As you mentioned, we did see a little bit of an appetizer at the beginning of last year in the bond market, which we do think is going to continue. We're excited about that. But in terms of what's in store for stocks, that's a little bit different question. This will be an interesting conversation. So, you know, one of the things that we wanted to point out was just how concentrated the S&P 500 is. So, you know, to give you an example, in 2023, there were 7 stocks out of the S&P 500. So for those of you who don't know, the S&P 500 is made up of 500, unironically, 500 publicly traded stocks. And of those 500, 7 of them were up 75%. In 2023 on average. So it was a huge jump. And yet the rest of the companies, the remaining 493, were only up 12%. So quite a disparaging difference, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And really quick, just to let our listeners know, those 7 happen to be Apple, Alphabet, which is essentially Google. Then you have Amazon, Meta, which was Facebook, but it sounds so much cooler as Meta and made the stock price go way up. Microsoft, NVIDIA, and lastly, Tesla. And so you kind of see a common theme, you know, amongst all those with technology and stuff. But so sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted our listeners to know kind of what those seven are. Yeah.
Who we're referring to. Yeah. And, you know, and so it's interesting. I mean, when you see that kind of a distinction in the market as a whole, it's important to note that the percentage of stocks that outperformed the index as a whole were actually the lowest in the past 30 years last year. So what you have is a situation where the vast majority of the stock market are have performance less than the index as a whole. And you know, that's a very crucial point, because historically what we see is that during healthy market rallies, usually you have the majority of stocks outperforming the index, and you know, because you have you know, the vast majority of those 500 companies increasing at a rate that is somewhat healthy because the economy is growing, earnings are growing, that sort of thing. And yet, right before we have crises or, you know, historically more difficult times for stock investing, what you tend to have is actually very concentrated rallies in some of the largest companies who tend to drag up the index.
Sure.
So for instance, in 1998, 1999, the percentage of stocks that outperformed the index were somewhere in the range of, you know, late or upper 20s, low 30%. So, you know, 2/3 or more underperformed the stock market during those 2 years. And then what did we have? We had the tech bubble burst in 2000. Similarly, in 2007, we had about 40% outperform the stock market. So again, another, you know, telltale sign of concentration. Then we had the credit crisis. And then, of course, in 2023, it was a similar story. So, yeah. And this has happened before.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting, too. You look back to, you know, 2018, 2019, where it was hovering right around 50%. And, you know, obviously 2020 hits and it drops down to around that 30, 35% mark. And you've obviously seen it kind of march up from there as far as the number of stocks that have outperformed. But we're seeing that number quickly dwindle. I mean, 2023 showing at, like you mentioned, 25% roughly.
Yeah.
And then another point on that, looking at the Mag 7 being up 75% in 2023 compared to the earnings revisions that were done in the fourth quarter of 2023, the entire S&P 500, or actually S&P 493 earnings per share were revised down 15%, while the Mag 7 was only up 4%. So you look at the stocks themselves being up 75% and earnings at 4%, that math doesn't add up.
Yeah, it's, you know, to go back to the theme of this podcast, it's not very sustainable, right? You have earnings increasing at a certain rate, and then you have the price of the underlying shares increasing at a, you know, 20-fold rate. That's not something that is going to last forever.
Right. So let's do something that we typically don't do, and we're going to look at the drivers for this thing to actually go higher, because I think it is important as an investor to understand both sides of the coin. It is important to understand what factors are out there that could, you know, melt this thing up or push this thing higher. One of the things we point to is the narrative that the market thinks that, you know, the Fed has achieved this soft landing. And, you know, we've seen them be way too late when it came to, you know, raising rates, when, you know, inflation, when the market was flooded with all this money.
Yeah.
We think that they're much way too late again to cutting rates and, you know, leaving these rates higher for longer. The longer they do that, the more damage, obviously, that's going to happen in the economy. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to nix that point. But possibly if the Fed somehow comes out of this with two wings on the plane and a soft landing is achieved, potentially that could push this thing higher.
Yeah, I mean, I think that narrative has really gathered steam over the last several months, because here we are about 18 months into this Federal Reserve rate hike cycle, and nothing has broken yet, right? There's been no dramatic reversal in payroll reports. We're not seeing a bunch of layoffs. GDP is still positive. And so, you know, it's been, again, 18 months, which is a long time for some people. And when you don't see something break or you don't see dramatic problems in the economy, all of a sudden people start to go, well, hey, maybe the economy's fine with these higher rates and maybe we're just going to continue to grow. And so that narrative is going to, you know, pick up steam.
The one point I would push back on, I think we are beginning to start to see the layoffs occur. Yet I think probably maybe what you meant is we're not seeing the fallout effect of any kind of layoffs per se.
Yeah. Yeah. We're seeing a lot of announced layoffs.
Right.
They're up dramatically over last year. And just in January, we've seen quite a few, specifically in some of these Magnificent Seven stocks. And yet the payroll reports continue to be what we would probably describe as somewhat deceptively positive. And yet just if you look at the tagline, if you look at the headlines, that's, you know, it's perceived as good news for the economy.
Right.
You know, you look under the hood and there's plenty of problems. But, you know, that I think is driving this narrative that, hey, maybe the Fed is not going to create a crisis. Maybe we're not going to have a recession. And if so, where do you want to be with a growing economy? You want to be in the stock market.
Sure.
So
and surely none of the job announcements or payroll numbers coming out, surely none of it has to do with an election year, if you will. And
right.
you look at really, the surprise jobs reports that have come out where it's like, wow, that actually the labor market looks pretty strong. Yet then the following quarter or month, you see them revise lower every single time. And it's like, so is that a coincidence or are these numbers actually bad? And, they just really wanted to make look a little bit better. Who knows?
Right.
But so let's move on, though, to the second point of another way this thing continues to go higher from here would be genuine economic growth. And we look at genuine economic growth today, and over the last 3 years, we have seen, GDP is up $6 trillion from the beginning of 2020 to now, to end of 2023, yep. While government spending was up $10 trillion. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it's not a good ratio, that's for sure. So historically, the neo-Keynesian model, which is kind of predominates in government circles these days, believes that when the private sector is faltering, government's job is to step in, stimulate the economy with spending, that sort of thing. And so that is to be expected. We had a pandemic, they shut the economy down, and the government stepped in with a massive amount of stimulus to try to stimulate the economy. As a result, we've had roughly $6 trillion of additional GDP added over the last 3+ years. The problem is that the Keynesian models always assume a positive money multiplier. There's all kinds of problems with this concept, but the idea is if the government spends $1 and there's a positive money multiplier, that means that every $1 the government spends will add $1.5 or $2 or $3 of economic growth to the economy. Well, just on the face of it, and just based on the numbers you just mentioned, what we found over the last 3 years is that for every dollar the government's spending in debt, we're getting about 60 cents of economic growth. And that's if you take these statistics at face value, which I'm not sure we should. And, there's other factors as well involved in our view that economic growth, despite government spending, is not likely to continue being positive. A few of those would be the leading economic index that is a government index that comes out monthly, and it's been in contraction territory now for months and months. It's never been in this kind of a range without a recession following. You add to that bank lending. Bank lending has been declining now for almost 12 months. Banks have been tightening credit conditions. And again, that has a delayed effect, much like Fed rate hikes have a delayed effect. We would expect, based on historical norms, for those tightening credit conditions not to really show up in the growth models of the economy until maybe mid-time this year, summertime, something like that. And then you add to that something that we've talked about in prior podcasts numerous times is the inverted yield curve, which, again, is a bond market indicator that has never been wrong in terms of its predictive power of seeing a recession before it shows up. And once again, it's at historic extremes. And so these are all, there's other indicators as well, but I'm just mentioning a few.
Right. And one, it's not necessarily a leading indicator, but you look at the number of corporate insiders actually selling stocks today. That number is skyrocketed.
That's probably a coincidence too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So then let's take a look at, what has happened historically when these, weightings get way out of whack like they are today with the Mag 7, driving this market higher, over the last year being up the 50% that it is while the rest of the, market is essentially flat. What has happened historically?
Yeah, well, and that massive outperformance in those seven companies has brought the concentration within the, and I'm going to narrow it to five companies just for historical comparison purposes, but the largest five companies in the S&P 500 now make up about a quarter of the entire market cap of the S&P. Which, sounds like a just an outrageous number, but we've actually been here before. The market was fairly concentrated back in the 1970s as well. But any student of, stock market history knows that the 1970s weren't really a good time for U.S. stocks, even though we had economic growth well, we had, you know, GDP growth, I should say.
Sure.
Yeah. We
new,
did have
new entrants into the workforce.
Yeah. Yeah. And we had high rates of inflation at the same time. But the S&P actually really did nothing for about 10 years from 1970 to 1980 during that highly concentrated period. And if you adjust it for inflation, it was actually down about 40%. It actually lost about 40% of its purchasing power. But that concentration did eventually dwindle, and into the mid 80s, it dropped before the historic, you know, it dropped below that kind of 15% range for the top five companies, which, you know, historically has been kind of where they land in terms of market cap. And it dropped all the way down to about 11% in the late 80s, early 90s. And actually I should say in the early 80s, it was down below 15%. And what's interesting is if you look at the S&P 500 from the early 80s to the late 90s, while the concentration was relatively low of those companies, the S&P 500 had its best 18-year period in the last 120 years.
Right.
You know, it was up, it was up what, I have the number here somewhere. It was up about 1,100% over a 17-year period. That's
wow.
pretty dramatic.
Yeah.
And all during that period, the top five companies made up about 11 to 12% of the index. But then you see it concentrate again, and it gets back up close to 20% right before the tech bubble burst in 2000. So we had another concentration. Obviously, everybody knows what happened in the tech bubble. The, you know, the S&P dropped about 50%.
Right.
Concentration, again, from early 2000 through about 2008 remained below the historic average. It had another spike in 2007, 2008, right before we had another crash.
Right.
And then it remained relatively muted all the way up until about 2018.
Yeah, and that's where it gets really interesting, because 2018, obviously, we saw the correction take place, kind of muddled along in 2019, and then 2020, COVID hits. And, you know, a lot of people looked at that as the recession, but actually nothing actually was cleansed. The bad debt remained. Nothing has essentially changed over the last 5 years. Yet back in 2018, many, many people saw that the S&P was probably due for a very major correction after an 8, 9, 10 year bull market run. So everything's the same today, yet the narrative is very, very different.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And as a result, we've seen again this concentration that has happened numerous times in the past, but it, you know, now the top five companies go from 15% roughly of the total index market cap up to, again, you know, about 25%. So once again, we're highly concentrated. But as you said, economically speaking, yes, profits have increased on a nominal basis over the last 4 or 5 years, but predominantly that's been due to government spending. It hasn't been done. It hasn't been due to productivity increases or anything like that. So, yeah, I mean, you know, fundamentally, the economy is not in much better shape. We are $10 trillion as a government more in debt now than we were 4 years ago, and roughly $6 trillion better in terms of GDP.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, we're in a precarious situation. Again, historically, you look at these kind of environments and you go, okay, well, what's most likely from here? Are we most likely to see sustainable stock market growth from here when we're this heavily concentrated? Or does history suggest that maybe there's lower growth on the horizon?
Sure. And I do think, I want to go back to the point for the a driver for it going higher from here, being the perceived safety of the U.S. stock market. You could say it's the, you know, the Mag 7 or just the U.S. stock market as a whole. And what we've seen happen overseas, we'll talk specifically about China. You've seen their stock market just continue to plummet as they've continued to print money to, you know, try to, they literally put in place laws not allowing shorting of stocks.
Yeah.
And yet you see stocks continue to reach new lows. Yet at the same time, as we've talked about, you see Japan's stock market, you know, start to go up. And so you look at it from that lens, that viewpoint of, if there is perceived safety, just perceived safety, not looking at fundamentals, not looking at drivers of future growth, but perceived safety, Could that be a reason for overseas dollars to just continue to flow into the U.S. stock market, pushing this thing higher?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably the only narrative that seems plausible to me. You know, you look over the last 30 years, even just the history that we were just talking about, you have concentration during the late 90s, during the Asian financial crisis. You have concentration into tech stocks. Now, a lot of people would point to that and say, well, it was because of the dot-com frenzy and that sort of thing. But, you know, that happened. And then, of course, in 2008, you see a spike in the concentration when we're in the midst of a recession. There's a lot of unknowns. We actually had a rally in the S&P 500 where it went all the way back up to its all-time high in 2008. This is during the recession. And then, you know, it sold off from there. But there was clearly concentration, consolidation within the index. And now you have it again. Yeah, I mean, certainly you look around the world today and you see a lot of concerns. China's growth just simply isn't there. You know, there's political upheaval. There's problems in the Middle East. You know, there's geopolitical conflicts with Russia and the West. And, you know, you see all this. And you realize, you know, if economic growth and innovation just simply isn't there, or it's not there to the same extent that it used to be, if you're an international investor and you have the option of investing your capital into debt or equity instruments in your own country, and you're not sure about the sustainability of your own country's growth, you may look at the U.S. and go, well, it's better than the alternative, so maybe I'll go ahead and buy Apple stock.
Right. It kind of comes back to the idea of the cleanest dirty shirt, if you will. It really doesn't matter that we have a dirty shirt. It just happens to be cleaner than everybody else's.
Yep. And as a result of all that, you know, it's just another interesting stat. When you look at the size of the U.S. Stock market, it's obviously always been the largest in the world. But that's become even more dramatic over the last year or two, to where now even the Magnificent Seven that you mentioned earlier, those seven stocks, just their market cap is larger than any other stock market in the entire world.
Right.
And that's just the seven largest
stocks. Right. So what happens? Yeah. You know, when one of those seven, for whatever reason, no one may know right now, but what happens when one of those goes bust and the money that comes out of that in particular stock doesn't go back into the stock market? In fact, maybe it just goes and sits in cash or over to bonds. You know, that could lead literally one stock taking out an entire index. That's very plausible, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if it's a one-off, maybe just, I mean, these are a lot of these big tech stocks are all connected in some respect. But, you know, if it's just one, maybe the index can weather that depending on how the money flows. Maybe it goes into the other stocks. Maybe it doesn't leave stocks, you know, and part of the perceived, as we're talking about, the perceived safety from an international perspective is that these stocks are safe. They are not at risk of bankruptcy. They're not at risk of defaults. And so the more their stock goes up, the more they're able to swap out their equity positions, which may be more expensive, for cheap debt positions.
Sure.
And that makes them financially even better off. That's not true for all of them, but it is certainly true for some. So, but I think the important thing and the point you were trying to make is that when you have this kind of concentration, it has a positive effect on the way up, where you can see the index driving up as it did last year, you know, up, what was it, 25% for the year or something like that.
Yeah.
While the vast majority, 490 of the companies, were up maybe an average of 12, and yet the index is up 25. So those seven companies have an outsized influence on the way up. The reverse is also true. If we all of a sudden see selling signals in the index, you had better believe that that the drop would be sudden and it would be potentially violent. We saw a little bit of that in March of 2020,
where
the index was down 35% in about a month.
Right, right. And really it just takes something coming out of right field to really just take this all out. One of those things, you know, being job loss continuing, especially at this rate that it is, like we mentioned, we aren't necessarily seeing the fallout effects yet of those job cuts, simply because a lot of those are upper management or higher paying jobs, which typically come with, you know, a nice severance package that'll get you by for 4 or 5, 6 months. you have unemployment. And so it's one of those things where sometimes these things take time. I think over this last 4 years, we have seen extreme movements that is very rare to find in the stock market, in the bond market. We've seen bonds go from 0% to 5%, and then in a 2 month period go from 5% down to 4%. I mean, it's very rare, but we are seeing extremes. And so it is very easy to get caught up in the, well, why isn't it happening yet? Why isn't it things take time, especially something like job cuts within an economy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and especially with the job cuts, what we're seeing, as we alluded to earlier, is that the headline numbers continue to show that the U.S. economy is adding jobs. And yet, if you look underneath the hood, over the last 3 months or so, full-time jobs, we've actually lost about 1.4 million full-time jobs while adding quite a bit more part-time jobs. So the overall jobs numbers look decent, but if you look under the hood, you go, well, wait a minute, why are we cutting full-timers and adding part-timers? Historically, we've only had a three-month period where we lost 1.4 million full-time jobs or more. We've only had that happen four times in the last 20 years. And one was in the dot-com bubble right before that burst. Two were in 2007, 2008. And then another time in March of in the first quarter of 2020. Again, none of those periods were positive for economic growth.
Right.
All of them were indicative of corporations seeing problems on the horizon and cutting full-time workers, maybe replacing them with seasonal or part-time workers to try to cut costs.
Right. And so obviously we look at 2020, and that was an economy shuts down. That's why we saw that drastic drop. Now what you're seeing is, I think, a lot of employers seeing a slowing economy, which is where then you begin to see that gradual cut and cut. And it's another 25% of the workforce. It's another 10% of the workforce. Eventually, those numbers do add up. And there will be pain. It's just, how far out does that go until it shows up in the data?
Yeah, it's very difficult to time, isn't it? But yeah. But at the very least, we can look at these indicators and see that there are warning signs all around us. There are storm clouds potentially gathering on the horizon, and it's best to be very, very cautious. You know, we talk about drivers of the U.S. stock market going forward. There are some potential drivers for higher prices, one of them being a very legitimate concern about perceived safety in the international economy, assets flowing into the U.S. That's one reason maybe to be cautiously optimistic about the U.S. stock market. However, as we look around and see the rest of the U.S. economy, we would urge people to be, cautiously, with the emphasis on cautious, cautiously optimistic about where U.S. stocks head from here. Meanwhile, the economy is presenting quite a few challenges going forward.
Sure, sure. Well, hey, Isaac, I appreciate your time today. Really look forward to our next conversation, and hopefully we have some fireworks here over this next month or two.
Should be fun. Thanks, Joel.
And that does it for another episode of Breaking Bad Advice. As always, you can find this episode along with the latest newsletters and blogs on planfinancial.com. Until next time, stay safe, stay rational.